Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Hugh Wisencroft. Lots to discuss today. We'll talk about how much we're enjoying Spurs as they stay at the top of the Premier League table. Also, taking a knee. It was booed by Millwall's fans. We'll get into the rights and wrongs of it. And in an age of VAR, how much should gamesmanship, aka cheating, be allowed? Alison Rudd, Matt Dickinson and Gregor Robertson. How you doing?
How are you? Very well, thank you. You?
By discussing Tottenham Hotspur next, because they're a great story in football, let's be honest. You know, top of the league, great team, play well, seem to have gelled, not playing tiki-taka. Jose Mourinho, the manager everyone loves to hate, on top of the table, and everyone's loving life. They beat Arsenal 2-0 in the North London derby as well, so it's a massive game for the club. Like I say, they stay top of the Premier League. But Alison Rudd, Jose Mourinho in particular has caught your eye. Tell us about the romance currently going on at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium.
I know why you're asking me that, Hugh. I wrote in the Times today that the real love affair was supposed to be when Mikel Arteta joined Arsenal. You know, the man who played for the club, he left the side of Pep Guardiola a little too early to make the sacrifice to bring glory back to Arsenal. The man who understood the club. A month earlier, Jose Mourinho had joined Spurs in exactly the opposite vibe. Spurs fans were groaning. They'd lost the love of their life in Maurizio Pochettino, and they had a complete pragmatist in charge. And they feared for what it might mean. I mean, I think a lot of fans were saying, we don't care if we win silverware. We care about the style in which we play. And I think what's happened is the true love affair now is at Tottenham, because it's not boring to watch Spurs at all. I would pay money to watch the Kane Son show. I think it's absolutely superb. I don't think any of the 2,000 fans who were at the stadium on Sunday would have not absolutely enjoyed watching Pierre-Emile Højbjerg do his stuff and make that team into something that could actually win something. He's probably the player of the season so far in terms of how he's single-handedly given grit to a midfield that could be very flaky. So I've not canvassed every Spurs fan. I'm sure there are some who are remaining entrenched and they don't like the fact that it's lovely times at the Old Lane, and it's him doing it. But I think also there are glimpses of Jose Mourinho actually displaying genuine affection for the club. I'm sure he arrived there thinking, "Oh, I love this stadium. I love what I've inherited. I think I can do things because I believe in my abilities." But the way his posturing, his words, his smiles, he's acting like he's unless he's a blooming good actor, he's behaving like he has fallen in love with the club too. I don't think anyone foresaw it would go this beautifully for the pair of them, the club and Jose.
He could be a really good actor. Who would play him in a movie? George Clooney, someone like that, you know, maybe more of an Iberian flavour, I don't know. Anyway, he's doing very, very well. It doesn't seem like an act. I've always, you know, everyone remembers my hot take from the start of the season saying Tottenham would be a top four team. And I truly believe it's because when a team is desperate for trophies, someone like Jose Mourinho, someone that you can look to as sort of the guru, the emperor, the king, he thrives in that sort of environment. And at clubs where trophies have been the norm, people see him as less of a guru and he's finding it a little bit harder. So I did have a feeling things would go well for him in North London, but I will reserve all of my gloating for the end of the season. He did say, though, Jose, whoa, you don't know how bad this gloating gets, Gregor. Okay, wait, like I say, wait until the end of the season. There will be a special on Tottenham, 60 minutes, no doubt. The front two of Kane and Son, like Alison says, I think we would all pay to watch them. Jose Mourinho says they're animals. And once again, and they were asked a lot about it after the game, Matt, the link up between the two of them was something to see.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, Kane's, you know, reinventing himself over the last couple of years as I mean, I wrote about him a couple of weeks ago. You know, he's a sort of, is he a nine plus, a mega 10? You know, he is sort of all of the above. He's a, you know, supreme finisher, now become a just this wonderful drop in the hole sort of playmaker as well. And, you know, with pace in front of him, what's not to love? I mean, I do think, you know, I think Jamie Redknapp talked about it a bit afterwards. I do think there is the flip side to this, which, you know, Spurs fans certainly won't want to hear now and probably don't need to hear now, certainly not for the next season. When you are asking top quality players to work like animals, as Jose says, there may be a limit to how much they ever want to do that, but I don't think that's going to be this season. You know, I think they're going to work like animals this season because they think they've got a real chance of trophies. And yeah, that could even be competing right to the end for the big one, the title. But I do think, you know, there comes a point where maybe star players don't fancy that shift, but I don't think it'll be anytime soon. Because it's working. And I think you speak to anyone around Spurs, like you said, the fact is Mourinho has got them buying into his methods because they think it can get them somewhere they haven't been before.
The one thing I'd say to that is even their star players haven't won anything. So, you know, if you go into a club, any club that Mourinho's gone to before, generally some of the players, you know, you've got big name players, but they probably have silverware in their, you know, in their trophy cabinets, and they have experience of winning. And if it's a very different, if it's a transformation from the way they've been playing in the past, that's helped them, you know, they've won that way, then they think, why do we need to play like this? I actually think that's only reserved, that only really reserved for a very small cohort of players, either the ultimate stars, you know, like, you know, could you get Neymar to buy into playing this way of football? Or players like a Mesut Ozil, who are increasingly being, you know, filtered out of the game. They're becoming slightly irrelevant because you have to, every team, no matter how you play, even if you're playing in Arteta's team, as much as it's misfiring, everyone has to buy into how the team plays without the ball. So that's modern football. But ultimately, Spurs, they just look ominously well-organised and drilled. And my only thing is if Kane or Son are injured, particularly Kane, because Kane is the kind of fulcrum. If Son was injured, they still have some players who can, you know, they've got the pace and the dynamism and can play off Kane. If Kane's injured, that whole dynamic shifts completely, and it would be interesting to see how they get around that.
Gregor, just as someone who's played, how much fun is it? Jamie Redknapp, the former Spurs captain, as Matt said, saying the Spurs players probably aren't having that much fun other than winning matches.
I was thinking this. I mean, I was a defender. So I think you have to, you know, you have to caveat what I'm going to say is I enjoyed being either the left back who was tucked in narrow and, you know, even if you're spending an hour of a game. I loved games where you went down to 10 men and you just had to batten down the hatches and grind out a win or a draw. I loved those games. Defenders do. What is the art to what Jose is doing is, as we're saying, getting the rest of the team to buy into it and to do it consistently and, you know, doggedly. But, you know, it's making players look better. I mean, you look at Eric Dier, and he's got players all around him. It's like a comfort blanket. He's never exposed. Same with Alderweireld, who's, you know, the last couple of years, he looks like he's slowed a little bit and he's not been the player we thought he was, and so they're all kind of compact. We said it last week, Sissoko and Højbjerg dropping in, they're all protected, they're all defending around their own box. That's great if you're a defender. You think, you know, we're going out to battle every week. And if you're winning, it feels brilliant. It's fun. But obviously, players like Son and Kane and Lo Celso and Bergwijn, if they're getting the goals, then it's fun for them too.
Alisson, do you think they're enjoying it other than the results, the style of play? I mean, there are lots of smiles from Harry Kane and Heung-min Son, especially when you win a North London derby and you get on the score sheet. It's going to be a happy day. Generally speaking, though, taking this football forward, if they play like this all the way through, do they still against the likes of Liverpool and Manchester City hold a chance of winning the title?
On the happiness level, you can play football like you're eating 8 bowls of Cocoa Pops over 90 minutes, as opposed to eating a bowl of salty, weak, watery porridge, but supplemented by a very expensive bar of chocolate. And that's what Spurs are. It's weak, watery, nasty porridge, but you get the bonus of a Son wonder goal or a masterclass from Harry Kane. And that adds that bit of extra something which they weren't getting before. So what it's balancing the type of beauty and the type of enjoyment you're getting. And I would say I would rather play in a team where it's stodge and hard work, but you do get that bit of luxury something in every game, almost every game, to make sure you're still in the hunt for trophies. The question of whether they will be at the end of the season, I agree with Gregor. I mean, but you can say that's about any team now, and they're all suffering injuries and they're all having to adapt. I don't think Spurs are a special case in that sense. I think he's got a very big squad. He keeps putting out a B team in Europe and then slagging them off. But on paper, they look good. I mean, it may be that if Harry Kane got injured, Gareth Bale could come in and just be a revelation. He looks very laid back on the bench, but maybe that's what would happen. So I think they'll definitely be top four finishes, and I think they could win silverware. And that's partly not just they've got a brilliant squad, but because Jose Mourinho, that's his job. That's why he was employed to go there. And I think his pride will mean that he does it. He will do it. Whatever it takes, how much porridge it takes, he'll do it.
Well, maybe, I don't know, Mikel Arteta needs to have is it Shreddies or Weetabix? Whatever one sets you up perfectly for the day, other good breakfast cereals are available. But Mikel Arteta, as Alisson already alluded to, was meant to be the saviour of Arsenal. And in many ways, he does need to take a lesson out of Jose Mourinho's book, Gregor, because pragmatism in terms of your shape and in terms of your team selection, maybe, but in terms of the application of the players, it's not there. It hasn't been very sensible of late.
No, I mean, I said this in a piece on Saturday. I think he has been pragmatic in that he doesn't want to play 3 at the back. He doesn't want to play 3-4-3, and you know, that's masking the deficiencies at the back that they have and the defenders they have, because the defenders they have aren't good enough. So I think that he has been pragmatic in that, but he's still got players who are indisciplined or, you know, have a moment of madness, or Xhaka goes around and kicking people, trying to make it look like he cares more than everyone else. Like, I still think he doesn't have the players. He doesn't have a squad as good as Spurs. People, I think it was maybe Redknapp again was saying, there's no difference between these two teams apart from Son and Kane or play for Spurs. I don't think that's true. I think Spurs have a better score than Arsenal now on paper as well. And yes, they have the star quality at the top end of the pitch. And yes, they are set up differently. But Arsenal weren't, you know, hiring a manager who was going to play like Jose Mourinho. That was never their intention. They want to. And the truth is, you know, we're talking about this style and substance. If Spurs start losing, or Spurs hadn't, I didn't think Spurs were going to do this well. I thought this was going to. I didn't think this was going to be a marriage made in heaven at all. So I admit I'm wrong. I was wrong on that. But if Spurs start to lose, then the grumbles are always more if your team are playing like Mourinho's are, as opposed to playing the football of Pep Guardiola or the football that Arteta wants to be playing. So that doesn't matter just now for Spurs because they're winning. But if they, you know, if they start to lose a few games, then people will look at the way they're playing and think, you know, we want to see more expansive football. And that's the position Arsenal are in now, because They've already tried to change it to be more defensive, and now they're trying to be more expansive, and it's not working. They don't have the player to join, to bridge the gap between midfield and attack. They don't have that creative spark, and they don't have, if they're throwing so many crosses into the box, they don't have anyone to get on the end of them.
It's not great reading the Premier League table if you're a fan of Arsenal, especially when you see where Tottenham Hotspur are and also Chelsea as well. And speaking of someone who sort of gets in the box and makes a difference, Alisson Olivier Giroud, he kept his starting place for Chelsea and he scored as well, and probably should have had another if it wasn't for Timo Werner's defensive work on the line as well.
Yeah, well, we're talking about romance a lot, and I think there's one unfolding at Stamford Bridge now, because Olivier Giroud, he's been patient, did all he could against Seville. I think I even suggested in the last podcast I probably wouldn't play him against Leeds because I felt they might scurry around too much for him. And in his post-match, Olivier Giroud actually said it's one of the toughest games he'd faced because he sort of looked around him. I mean, they'd left the pitch at that point, but it was as if he could feel them on his shoulder, that they don't half work hard and made life difficult for him. And I sort of feel if you can come through the test of hyper-energetic leads and still score and still look the part and still have an impact on the game, then he can now do anything. I mean, he probably needs resting from time to time, but I would sincerely hope he gets a lot more starts for his club this season than he did last.
I love the idea that scoring one goal against Leeds tells you more than scoring four goals against the Europa League winners Sevilla in the Champions League, of course. You know, that's the real test. Leeds United at home. It was a great weekend for him. Let's hope he goes from strength to strength as well. I think we got an indication during that game that the difference between Tammy Abraham in the box and Olivier Giroud in the box, there is a presence there that I don't think Tammy has, as good as a young player he is, and look, can still improve, of course. But Alisson, I wanted to ask you about Liverpool as well. Aside from the fact that they had a fantastic win this weekend, really, fans returning in the Premier League, we got to see the Kop this weekend without its usual flags and banners, but with fans in it once again. And I thought it was one of the great things of the weekend, the noise that we heard inside Anfield. It felt more so than the games that I've been to and had seen in other leagues and in the Premier League as well on Saturday. It felt more like football was back at Anfield. I don't know how you saw it.
Yeah, no, I'm welling up, you can probably see. I spent most of the game thinking, will Klopp go to the Kop and will he do his normal fist pump and get them cheering, or will he feel that it's unfair on those who aren't there, or will he be worried that 2,000 fans won't be able to make the right noise back at him? But he did it, and they sounded just as loud as a packed Kop would have. And I don't know, I suspect when they put together montages of Klopp's reign, that will be near the top of it, actually. And it was very beautiful. And the team actually did play like they had a full stadium behind them. They had that effortlessness back and that sense of all things are possible. There was no self-doubt at all. And it just felt like they were back being a family again. So it was, and I know I'm utterly biased, but I suspect anybody who loves football who watched that were just really, really chuffed that it felt like there was a connection again.
I'm utterly biased against Liverpool, Alisson, as you know, but I often get a lot of stick. I often get a lot of stick from people for saying, for example, I put on social media what a privilege it was to be at Anfield. This was during lockdown and there were no fans inside the stadium, to which a lot of Manchester United fans were very unhappy with me. And every time I go on air and talk about what a great place it is when there are fans in a full stadium, I also get a lot of stick as a Manchester United fan, but you can't deny it, unfortunately. And for me, it was one of the great things to see this weekend as well. Fans returning in many places, maybe not as cheerfully elsewhere. Millwall's fans in the Championship this weekend hitting the headlines with what was clearly, I think, an orchestrated booing of their players and the players of Derby County taking a knee. Now, I think we've seen on social media and elsewhere Millwall fans claiming it was a stand against the anti-Marxist, riotous looters that want to defund the police, end capitalism, and my particular favourite, end the family structure as a unit. I don't know how they're going to do that one. I'm talking about Black Lives Matter for those people who are unaware. Now, of course, Black Lives Matter didn't come up with taking the knee. We've seen it in sport, of course, Colin Kaepernick in American football, and it's transcended. It's gone throughout sport across the world. And we saw during the summer the EFL and the Premier League distance themselves from Black Lives Matter, remove it from players' shirts as well, due to some of the more controversial comments that have been made, and I think the formation of a political organization called Black Lives Matter. But players continue to take the knee in support of ending discrimination in sport, generally speaking, and racism as well, of course. Millwall's players did put a statement out before the game against Derby explaining it had nothing to do with any political messaging or ideology, and they've been pretty explicit on that one. But all of that, I think, fell on deaf ears to the Millwall fans, because clearly, as players from Millwall and Derby went down to take a knee, they were strongly booed, even though they made very clear that it was against racial and social injustice. And of course, the reaction, the backlash has been very strong, but it has led to a debate. Interestingly, I think, on these ones, you know, the Millwall fans, those players that booed and people that backed them on social media, at least, were so supportive of the freedom of speech element. You know, it's our right to make whatever stance we want if that's what we want to do, except, of course, if you're one of the players on the pitch taking a knee, and then, of course, you shouldn't be allowed to voice your freedom of speech. But, you know, I think it's an interesting topic for us to discuss nonetheless. Matt, do you think it was racist? I think a lot of people were arguing about whether it was a racist act or not.
You know, my immediate reaction, like a lot of, I would say, well-meaning and right-minded people, was shock and dismay and, well, I'd go further than that. So abhorrence, to be honest. It you know, we can talk all, well, they can talk all they like about, you know, the BLM's connections with a political movement, but we know that those players at that time were making a simple stance against racism. That, you know, there is nothing more complicated in taking the knee than that. And if you want to object to someone taking a stance against racism, then, you know, that's a pretty depressing state of affairs. I find it depressing from so many points of view. I mean, you see the reaction on whether it's social media. I would say, you know, sadly, even the reaction on, you know, when we write about this sometimes on Times comments, you know, that it becomes this hugely polarized debate about sort of wokeness and, you know, that we don't end up having a discussion about what are we doing about racism. We end up having, say, an increasingly fraught, polarized debate about, you know, how dare these players do this? How some people feel like they have to sort of stand up against wokeness, against this sort of campaigning, as if they're, I'm not quite sure why there is a need to take that stance, you know, as the same way as why on earth is there the need to boo what was intended as a simple anti-racism display at the weekend. And it's that polarization that I find, you know, I know going into social media is not reflective a lot of the time of a lot of the world, but that polarization I just find scary, to be frank.
It's easy for us to sit here and say we're appalled by it, but I don't think that helps anyone or anything or any movement. I think you have to think about why they did it. And I think there are a lot of disenfranchised young white men who are angry at the attention that one issue, they see it as one issue, which is racism, gets lots of attention, and their lives are rubbish and it's not fair. And I think they need, if they're angry enough to boo something which is arguably inarguable, that all those players are doing, if you ask any player why they're taking the knee, they say, oh, it's not a political thing. We just think we have an obligation that when people watch a football match, they are reminded about inequality, and we can start conversations. And also, we want to show that we are all in this together, and that if we're white, we have black teammates, and we want to show them that we care about the issues they face. It's about unity. We're not trying to be divisive at all. It's just about raising an issue and hoping we can all show support for one another. But that's an intelligent, rational approach. But there are people who've been denied their shouting at a football match since March, who have pent up issues, unemployment, not knowing what their future holds, and their only way of showing what they feel is at a. That's always been the case. Is to unload at a football match. And they've gone there and they've probably all riled each other up into believing that taking the knee is politicised and against them. So what you have to do as Millwall is you just have to educate, and you have to say, this is not against you, our supporters, our core supporters. This is for all of us. Please do not do this, because this is what we represent as a club, and you can't deny entry to a fan who wants to boo. I mean, how would you feel if the Millwall fans had all booed a player who'd refused to take the knee? There'd be a different debate, but it would be similar, wouldn't it? It would be about your right to show your disapproval of someone's political beliefs. All you have to do is dialogue rather than say you're appalled by it, because there's a reason behind it. I don't think it's necessarily purely racist. I think people feel disenfranchised, and it's a sort of crude way of letting the world know that they're angry.
I maybe agree with you that maybe not everyone's motivation is racism, but I do believe that the act of booing something that is anti-racist, you know, if you're going to be negative about something that is anti-racist, it's by definition probably racist. And I wonder whether they had put that level of thought into it, whether they thought, how will this be seen? I'm not sure whether it was all about, let's just voice our displeasure. Look, it's an interesting one, because I would say, how can you really, as Millwall fans, if you genuinely do believe about this, change the conversation by booing the players taking a knee, as opposed to getting your message in through the club to the players by voicing your concerns directly to them and saying, we'd rather you didn't. Maybe they have already. But they didn't leave themselves with much room to have a nuanced conversation about it by immediately booing players of Derby County and their own team, Millwall. So it's a tough one. I understand what you're saying about the various factors that are going on in people's lives, and maybe that went into their decisions, but I still find it hard to say that it wasn't a racist act, because, you know, if someone was in front of me and they were against sexism and I was saying, no, I don't want to hear from you, I don't want to hear what you have to say, you know, it's whatever my motivations are, if I'm, you know, that it's almost like I'm pro-sexism then. And that's how it felt. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's how it felt, whether there was a thought process behind it or not. You know, if you want to close down that conversation, then you're against it. You know, in my opinion, it's just an opinion.
Obviously, everything you're saying makes perfect sense. But we're dealing with people who maybe don't think things through in a perfect sense sort of way.
I think the problem is that the players explicitly said that it wasn't, you know, not to conflate these issues. It's just very sad that that's happened. It's Black Lives Matter's kind of movement, or making this taking the knee, is being sucked into a political debate that's, you know, it's almost like, I think it's almost like a get out clause for some people to kind of who are racist to you know, voice their hatred of this almost. And there are other people who, you know, it's very layered, and I think I just think it's very sad that it's kind of that the players have explicitly said that this is not anything to, you know, I don't know any footballers who know anything about Karl Marx. Who are on the far left of the political spectrum. I think we can safely say that, and the players made it clear. That's the thing we have to state. So Millwall fans have chosen to ignore what the players said and still boo it. And I hate the act of booing. Anyway, I mean, even if you disagree with it, you don't have to boo it.
you know, I think there's a place to debate where the gesture is going, what happens beyond it. I think, you know, Les Ferdinand and QPR started that by saying they weren't going to be taking the knee. I mean, this is a club that's done more than most for equality and opportunity. But yeah, they said that there does need to be a discussion about, you know, is this indefinite? Is it still having the same impact? You know, what more are we doing in the game other than, you know, showing this on a Saturday afternoon? And I think that is a very important debate. And we do have to look, you know, beyond the knee is absolutely vital. But I still, when you come back to it, yeah, I still just, you know, that noise only that noise only said one thing to me, and it was pretty unpleasant.
But do you not feel it's worth giving them another chance? I know the players said that this wasn't a political thing, but I still think there was this overwhelming sense of we're back. This is our first game back. And it was almost irresistible for Millwall fans not to just feel they wanted their voice heard. If the club did not, why doesn't the club just say to them, okay, look at the effect that your booing has had. You are now being tarred as racist. And that means you are insulting everyone of colour who's worked for this club behind the scenes or on the pitch. Is that really what you want to do? And if you boo taking the knee again, we will deem that you are being racist, whether you were claiming it or not. And if they do it again, then we can all lay in on them. I just think it was a perfect storm of coming back and being angry about things that we don't want them to be angry about.
But if you go on, I would say, I'm always loath to sort of quote social media as if that's any sort of forum for common sense. But if I did scan a few of the posts that were on, and then you go underneath and there are dozens, if not hundreds, you know, maybe thousands for all I know, of people defending, Millwall fans going very actively on, defending the booing, saying, you know, defending whatever stance it came from, saying, you know, we're not going to have this shoved down our throats, etc., etc. You know, it was done, you know, deliberately, consciously. You know, people wanted to stick two fingers up. And as you say, they maybe some people can rationalize that for whatever reasons, but I don't think we can say it was a sort of, you know, just a sort of spontaneous sort of, you know, rejection of something. It was very deliberate. It's been sort of supported by many fans who were either there or would love to have been there. And, you know, as you say, maybe there's a place to examine the forces behind it. Equally, I think it can be sort of condemned without too much tippy tapping around it as well, I think.
But we can, but if you condemn, absolutely. But you, for every action, there has to be, you have to learn from it and grow from it. But because you cannot prosecute for racism in this instance, they haven't done anything illegal. So how do we move this on by just saying, we believe they were being racist. We believe it was a concerted effort to be racist, and we were appalled. Why not use it as a starting point to try and differentiate out the different reasons for the anger there?
I think you can. Hugh was mentioning it before. I think you release a statement much more along the lines of the one that the Colchester chairman did, which was laying out. He even had discussions with one of his players about where his feelings stem from. And why he feels it's important to take the knee. And you relay that from someone who, you know, has a position of power in the club. You make it clear why the players are doing it and why the club is supportive of that. And he's even said that he wants them to applaud when the players do it next. So, you know, there might be some cynical part of you says that makes it easier. You wouldn't hear the boos if there was applause. But he's making the club's position very, very clear. And Millwall, I'm not sure they've really done that. Millwall have come out and said, we do a lot of good stuff and you're tarnishing that. They're not saying the players, this is why the players are doing it and we support them. And if you're not going to support them, then don't come to our club. That's what they should be saying.
Yes, well, I agree. I agree with that completely. I agree. Let's take it as something that happened and if you can educate those fans into seeing what it doesn't, they haven't got that get out clause of saying that they were being against a political movement. Some people need to have to just be shown it very clearly that what they believe.
I don't think you frame it as education though either, because that a lot of people will not take that well. I think you just lay out, you make the point very clear why this is happening and why the club are supporting it. If you choose not to do so, then they won't come.
Yeah, no, I would support that. I would support that. But listen, I think you have to use it, don't we? Hugh, don't you think you have to use the fact that it happened to concentrate the debate again, so that, because yeah, this is a new phase of football, isn't it? The fans are coming back.
One of the things that we sort of, we do too easily is to say people need education and they need to learn from this, as if they had no idea before. You know, people, let's be honest, they know that they know the ins and outs of it. You know, it's not like one football team in the country has fans who have absolutely no idea what's going on, and the other football clubs, you know, like all of the people who have no idea what racism or discrimination or taking the knee means to support Millwall, you know, as a massive coincidence. Of course, they know the ins and outs of it as much as fans of any other club do, but they have chosen to get together to make that decision. And if you don't think it's along lines of race or xenophobia or anything like that, then like, I agree with you. You do have to ask about the motivation for it. But you can't say that the things that afflict Millwall fans socially or economically don't affect fans of other football clubs, because they do. So whatever is happening at Millwall is not a unique circumstance at a football club or within a group of football fans.
No, I was just thinking about how the game responds, how you know, if I was a black player at Millwall would respond, or Queen's Park Rangers for that matter, which is who they play next. I mean, I saw, you know, there's a really interesting piece from Darren Lewis, one of our colleagues in the Mirror, talking about, you know, whether as a player you'd walk off. You know, is that what's left? And you think, well, you know, okay, if we talk about, you know, we've had debated and, you know, whether players, you know, they have walked off, obviously there's, you know, UEFA brought in these steps of different things, but, you know, in the face of racist abuse, it is one of the measures that a game is either halted or, you know, there's warnings to the crowd, players walk off. Now, you know, if we are thinking there is, you know, there is racism behind that noise, whether from all or, you know, some, then is that the territory we're in now where players walk off? It's a fair question to ask. And I'm really intrigued to think of what discussions might be going on privately between the black players of Millwall and QPR and the director level and so on about what might happen.
I mean, look, my I tried to write a piece on this for the Times, and I genuinely wrote about four different articles, none of which I thought was any good or no one would want to read in the Times anyway. The general thrust of which, you know, my personal view is I wouldn't have wanted to play if I was certainly one of Millwall's players. And I also wondered whether the context of Derby County season meant they just carried on as well, because, of course, they're in vital need of points at the moment, having been at the bottom of the table, and whether their decision-making might have been different if they were towards the top of the table. What I hate, I've got to say, is people using Les Ferdinand's views and QPR's decision not to take the knee is like the standard. I mean, we have this a lot, sort of black people who speak about things becoming the rule. You know, happens a lot with John Barnes, for example. You know, he says something about race and suddenly everyone turns around and says, see, John Barnes said it, this must be fine, because, you know. And it strangely, Les Ferdinand's statement was about making and doing something more than taking a knee. He wasn't trying to get rid of taking the knee because he thought it was pointless. He was saying people in football need to do more than a gesture. They need to do more than this. He also didn't have a problem with other people continuing to take a knee, clearly. He wasn't saying we should all stop doing it. He was really asking what more can we do? But there you go. I think one of the things that I think was painful was Millwall's statement. I mean, they didn't mention the word black or race or racism at all in their statement. They didn't say anything about their fans potentially coming back to the game. And as Greg has already said, there were boos at Colchester. I think there were some mutterings as well, some murmurs at West Ham United as well. But Colchester, you know, put out a very strong statement this morning saying, if you're going to boo, don't come back. And if you want a refund on your season ticket, let us know. And that was that. And it would have been, I think, a stronger sign for Millwall to have done that. To be honest, it sounded like at Millwall, no one wanted to alienate their fans. You know, the post-match comments from Gary Rowett, the manager, were very much tiptoeing around the issue for me. He never really got to the heart of it, never really seemed to have an understanding of what really the issue was. So, you know, his comments for me were poor. The statement matched up with that as well. I don't like the idea that people seem to be making out at the moment that the players are forced to take a knee. They're not. As you saw, Colin Kazim Richards playing for Derby County in that stadium, who is black, not take a knee. He feels it's better to stand and raise a fist. No one is making anyone take a knee. And those are the comments that sort of, they're not hurtful. They're, you know, it's not that people have to do anything, but it just shows a lack of understanding, I think, that, you know, it's not just football fans, you know, listening to the radio this morning. There's almost an idea that players are forced into doing it. I don't know, maybe they are. Maybe you guys have spoken to players that do feel they're forced to take a knee. And of course, irony is dead when it comes to Millwall fans as well on this, because the actions of a few associated with Black Lives Matter have suddenly become the actions of everyone who says the words Black Lives Matter. But of course, the Millwall fans who were chanting racist abuse against Everton in the FA Cup last year, no, that's not Millwall fans. You know, that is a small section of us. Don't tar all Millwall fans with the actions of a few. But of course, when it comes to Black Lives Matter or anything to do with race, of course, that is the view of everyone. And I think it was just a sad day for football personally, but there you go. Gregor?
I think you've summed up there very eloquently. I mean, I would say that, you know, we shouldn't jump on Gary Rowett because you have a microphone thrust upon you and you're trying to, you know, navigate what is a complex and difficult issue. And I know you could have been stronger, but I would say that undoubtedly the statement could have been stronger. And they, as you said, they had nearly 24 hours to think about how it was going to be phrased and what they were going to say. And I felt that was quite defensive, whereas as the Colchester owners was on the front foot. And it actually was positive. It laid out all the good things about what had happened that day, about fans returning and having, you know, this is a step forward and you were great supporting the team and everything. This is all good. But I'm not happy about this. I've had these discussions with the players. This is why they're doing it. I support that. The club supports that. If you come to support the club, you should support that. And if you don't, then I would rather you didn't come, basically. I think that really, it was in what is quite a complex, you know, a difficult thing to navigate. I think that should be the position of football clubs at the moment, because the players, as you say, it's their choice. It was their choice on day one when they did it, and it's still their choice ultimately now, I think. Perhaps there are some who have been, you know, thinking, when is this going to end? I don't know. It is an interesting discussion, maybe one for another day, because...
Oh, no, that was my next question, actually.
Okay. Well, you know, because ultimately, from my point of view, and you could tell me if I'm wrong here, because there's a very good chance I will be, it has been diluted a bit, and what you really notice about it now is almost every week someone forgets and runs off when the referee blows a whistle, or when we hear this with something negative associated with it, it brings up the debate again. I remember the first time that happened and being going, wow, you know, that was really impactful, and it doesn't feel like that way for me now. But I still have no problem whatsoever with it happening, and it's the player's choice. And I'd be completely open to hearing the views of others as to why they feel it's still important to do it. And rather than having an end game in sight and having a, you know, knowing what steps are being taken actually, as people have said, to enact change that we will kind of feel is tangible and recognisable. That is obviously the most important thing. And so I don't know. Over to you guys.
Well, I just think that question you ask, I mean, that's why I come back to that point about tomorrow night, because the more you think about it, the more you think there chances are there going to be some people turning up who sadly are feeling like the attention's going to be on them. It's a lot of people are talking about it, and they're going to, I fear some people will sort of revel in, you know, we've seen it before at Millwall, let's be frank, you know, potentially revel in that notoriety. And therefore, you know, they'll be even more focused on that. And that's it. That's where I'm really intrigued about how, you know, the clubs, both clubs' sets of players respond to that. And not as a news, you know, I mean, it will make news, but as a, where is this helping? Where is this taking? What use can come of it? Yeah, Alison mentioned about education then. Is any of this going to prove educational, or is it back to the point I made right at the start of just actually it's just sort of, you know, pushes polarization of some people? I'm asking questions here, not answering them, to be honest, but I just find sort of a certain amount of dread going into tomorrow night thinking about any of it.
Harry Kane said, you know, if somebody's taking their child to a game for the first time and the child asks, why is this happening, and you explain it to your child, that's, you know, he said that recently, that's perhaps a valid view, but I just don't know what do you feel here?
Look, there's part of me that wants to stick two fingers up and say keep it going forever for all the people that want to boo, and I'd kneel in their faces as long as they're booing me. If I was a player, to be perfectly honest, I'd want to do it for the rest of my career, but I'm not, so I don't know. And it's not that I have a particular backing of Black Lives Matter. It's more, like I say, just to put two fingers up, and maybe that dilutes it as well. It can't last forever. I know a lot of people are making reference to the clap for carers that happened on a Thursday night as well, and us showing gratitude to the NHS, and these things must come to a natural end as well. But I do think when you take the knee before the game, I know it sounds weird, it does more than the Tannoy announcement saying, it's a game for everyone, please don't abuse the players today. It is a small, short moment where the crowd goes quiet and everyone is just reminded not to abuse anyone today. You know, and, you know, in that regard, I think it's much more powerful than the signs that we have around the ground or the email or text that you get pre-match to remind you to behave. And like you say, for young people, just to ask the question, why are the players doing it? But interestingly, the explanations are going to be different. The answers to that question are going to be different. If I go to Millwall with my dad, he's probably not going to say, you know, what I would say to my child if I took them to the football on what it means. And I think if it's going to continue, there needs to be more probably education on what it means, even though, yeah, education might not be the right word, but there needs to be better understanding. How we get there is probably education. But Alison, do you think it should end soon?
How on earth do you end it unless you end it formally? You can't have it sort of trickling out with one or two players deciding, should we now do it or not do it? And you can't let it sort of die a death slowly. That would lead to all sorts of problems and people being accused of things that they, you know, that weren't true. I mean, are you just getting bored of racism, a fight against racism? So
that's happened.
I think it was
Coventry v QPR, was it? I can't remember. One team didn't, and then the other were, you know, there was some disagreement about why that didn't happen. And the two teams have got to agree beforehand now in the EFL, yes. Certainly.
Yes. It can't look like, oh, we're just getting bored of this as an issue. But then the alternative is that you decide at a point in the season, whether it's the end of the season, that you say, this is not something that's going to happen now. But then you'd have to say, why not? And then you'd have to list the reasons, the progress that has been made. How you quantify that, I have no idea. How as football, you can say, we feel we've made strides in the right direction in combating racism, both in football and in the wider society. They'll not be able to say that. So it's really difficult to know how to end it at the right point so that it doesn't look like it's just petered out and people don't care when they clearly do care. Maybe you have to come up with something that replaces it, refresh it, so that you have the dialogue going again, that you have the wow moment again at the start of football when, you know, even the commentator wasn't expecting it and it felt goosebump moment that, you know, at last football was taking a sensible political approach to a big, big problem in the game. Maybe that is the only answer, that you end the taking of the knee, but you bring in something that allows the conversation to continue. I don't know what that would be.
It's a big question I think football's going to have to answer over the coming weeks and months as well. Plenty for us still to discuss, though, on the Game podcast today. But a reminder, if you do enjoy it, the podcast, that is, give us a 5-star rating. No other things. Those of you with your minds in the gutter, give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, whichever you use. You should never say it willy-nilly, to be honest. And make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss the next episode. To enjoy more of our award-winning sports journalism, subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times today. You'll get yourself 1 month free. Just search thetimes.co.uk/the game when you go online.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, more debates for us on the Game podcast as well. Things that we don't like to see in football, to keep that theme going as well. We never like to see what we might perceive as cheating in football. We hate diving, for example. There were a couple at the weekend. Can't believe they weren't given it yellow cards. But by the way, we should note the other day, a yellow card was given for diving in the Premier League. So the refs are back, apparently, at the moment. But at the weekend, there could have been a player, Ian Pervaeder, for Leeds against Chelsea, could have gone down. A little flick of the boot from Ben Chilwell could have gone down, won his team a penalty, decided to stay on his feet. A lot of people happy with him. If I was a Leeds fan, I wouldn't be too sure about that. And also John Egan, the Sheffield United defender, last minute of the game, Jamie Vardy races through on goal. He's got a choice to make. Take him out, get a point, or allow him to go through and in the end score the goal that won Leicester the match. I know what I would have done in both situations, but maybe that says more about me than it does about anything else. How much, though, is gamesmanship / cheating okay in the game? And what would you have done in those two scenarios? There might be a bit of debate on this. Like I say, Gregor, I'll start with you.
John Egan's, I think I would have taken him out. In fact, I have taken a player out like that. So I saw red. I think there was even maybe 10 minutes to go. It's against Sunderland. And I remember walking back in the tunnel just like with my eyes closed and Julio Arca taking a free kick and I think he hit the bar. I was like, got away with it. But we didn't. They scored in the 90-somethingth minute and won. So anyway, yes, when you're a player's running through like that, it's quite hard. You know, you've got your calculating a lot of different things in split second. You know, do you want to miss three games? Is that important in the context of the rest of the running? You might miss. There's a lot of calculations going on in your head. But ultimately, I think with Jamie Vardy's running through and it is genuinely an injury time, yeah, take him out. So that's that one. The Pervaeder thing, I can't give you an answer. I'm so conflicted about it. I feel like I'm glad he didn't go down. But at the same time, he's stupid not to go down because it is true that if he goes down, the likelihood is he'll get a penalty. Even if it's a delayed reaction nowadays, it's just almost admitting the fact that the contacts you made, then I would like you to make the decision for me. I don't want to continue with this chance and, you know, take the shot, a weak left foot shot as he did. So you're basically saying to the referee, make the decision for me. And that is modern football. And so while I wish it wasn't so, I'm afraid he was daft not to go down.
Two yeses from Gregor Robertson on this.
Long-winded yeses.
Cheater. Alison, what would you have done?
We're now saying that horrible thing known as VAR should now be part of tactics and pre-match discussion and in a player's head when he decides whether or not, because before VAR, there's no way we would be having this discussion, because the contact was so slight that the player would think, well, you know, there's every chance I'll just get booked for diving, or the referee won't see it. I mean, why is the referee going to see something so minuscule? But now, are we saying that players should be going into a game thinking, well, if anybody touches me, that will be shown on a replay 16 times. Someone's going to see contact. I'm going to get the penalty. So if I'm touched, my instinct should be not to keep going, because there's no need for me to fall down because I'm not unbalanced. I can still see sight of goal. I would love to score a wonder goal. But my instinct should be, because of review after review after review, I will get a penalty, which means that VAR is not only sort of retrospectively ruining the game, it's ruining the game before you've even kicked off. This is a disgraceful discussion.
It's professional sport. This happens in a raft of different sports. You know, the technology, the timeouts, whatever they give you, you should use to your advantage. We see NFL players running through and stopping at the line instead of scoring an actual touchdown, because they know that if they get three more attempts or four more attempts to score a touchdown, they can just run the clock down and still score from 1 yard out, which is exactly what they do. So look, you've got to use the advantages in front of you. Like on Gregor's point on the calculations that you make, well, John Egan made a load of calculations because he actually puts his arms up to show the referee that he isn't going to foul Jamie Vardy. You know, I'm sitting there as a Sheffield United player saying, we've barely got any points all season. We've got the chance of a draw against Leicester. No one cares if you play the next three games, to be perfectly honest, even though they've got injuries at the moment, because points are more important than, look, the next three games we'll have 11. Let's put it that way. We'll have 10 for about 30 seconds and we'll probably get a point against Leicester. You know, those are the calculations in professional sport that you need to make. You need to do what's best for the club, for the team, for the organization, rather than yourself. And in terms of going down, if they're gonna bring in technology that makes it really easy to get a penalty, well, then you've got to use it.
But Hugh, you say professional sport. I ran the line on a park pitch yesterday, and it never ceases to amaze me. Like, you know, someone kicks the ball out and they appeal for the throw-in all the bloody time. I mean, it's just it's sort of instinct. I don't know what age that sort of moment tips in, but. Yeah, you know, you're playing a park game. It, you know, who gives a stuff apart from you whether you win it or not? Is, you know, it is nothing in the world, and yet you're appealing for absolutely everything, even though you know full well it is nothing to do with you. And that's what leads to Gregor's awful cynicism about when it comes to exploiting it. Now, I will just make one point on because Alison and I obviously can't be on a podcast without arguing about VAR for at least 30 seconds. But this is having spoken to Mr. Ellery, who is responsible for all ills in the world, according to some, but he, on that Pervader thing, a lot of people made the comparison with the Welbeck incident, obviously, and you know, that the slightest contact leading to a penalty. And he basically made the point that this is where we're going wrong with VAR. And I think all of us would agree. I think most people would agree. The whole point is it is not meant to pick up these minuscule touches and be re-refereed. That is where the system has gone wrong, is failing. It's meant to be clear and obvious. And if we are having to look at 10 replays, then that's not when it should be used. So
it's maybe already changed the game, though.
Well, yeah, but you can change it back. I mean, the fact is, sure. You know, you don't have to, you know, well, it's ultimately up to a referee to decide, is that a penalty or not? And he can, you know, habits change, guidance changes, the way we referee changes. And if we can head back to a world where small touches are not given, and we should.
But all you're doing is letting a man in a box makes the decision whether it was a clear and obvious mistake. It's just one other person making that decision.
Or even worse, he sends them to a screen, which adds pressure and basically says, I think you've got to give this. Or subliminally,
I don't see
anyway.
How does the screen add pressure?
Well, let's look at the West Bromwich Albion Pereira sending off. That was nothing. Absolutely nothing. But the fact that he went, no chance. The fact that he went to the screen almost, you know, doomed him. It was like, you look at this, you'll see it in slow motion several times. His foot kind of pushed up about 6 inches. And that was a red card. And
deliberate movement.
I mean, it was like a fractional movement. You could not say that was a red card. It's the kind of thing that people miss.
I've seen completely. Patrick Vieira get sent off for an air kick against Ruud van Nistelrooy 20 years ago, mate. So if football's changed since then, I'm sorry. If the motion towards the player, Heung-Min Son's, you've been sent off for the same thing as well.
It's not the same. Heung-Min Son did a backflip like towards him. This was like his studs moved about 3 inches. I thought that was embarrassing. He could have almost been saying he was protecting himself at first. Might have fallen on him. They discussed this in Match of the Day 2 last night, and it was quite good. You know, just there's no human touch anymore in refereeing, and I know this is. We're all sort of partly to blame for this. This is the route down which we kind of want to travel for so long, but it's gone to an extreme that is just. I think it's changed the game, and not for the better.
How can you have somebody watching on a monitor at Stockley Park who sees a mistake, an error? He sees it as a fact on his screen, but then has to think, I'm not sure how clear and obvious this is. Those two things are impossible to have running at the same time. So David Ellery can say that, but he's created a philosophical nightmare. You can't say, oh, I've seen contact where the referee did not see contact, but it wasn't clear and obvious contact. That is purely one individual's interpretation of it.
Yeah, but that's refereeing. Refereeing always will be one individual's interpretation. That's the point. That's what we got to get back to, and have, you know, referees have to have the confidence to bring their subjective view to it. That's the point. We can't be chasing this sort of... They can't be chasing the perfection or the minuscule touch. It has to be the subjectivity, more subjectivity has to return, and how much we love that.
Can we just quickly highlight as well that yet again, a player dived, a penalty was given, the penalty was rescinded, and the player wasn't booked, Conor Coady. I just don't know what players have to do now to get booked for diving. It was the most blatant thing. He went over to the monitor,
Conor Gallagher,
saw it, he changed it.
Against Palace, should have got...
Yeah, it wasn't quite as blatant, but it was a dive. I mean, what do you have to do nowadays to get booked for diving? There's like a grey area that, like, it's impossible. The referee changes.
Hang on, Greg. You're the cynical old pro who said that these guys should be, you know, hacking down Jamie Vardy. And
if you feel the contact,
I have to ask, because I want a sense of everyone's moral compass on the show today. Me and Gregor, we've already thrown ourselves under the bus. Matt Dickinson, if you're Pervader, do you dive?
Absolutely not. I'm an upstanding member of society.
You're John Egan, do you take Jamie Vardy out and get Sheffield United a point?
Yeah, there's no way I'm catching Jamie Vardy.
There was no way John Egan was going to catch Jamie Vardy, so you don't have to feel shame for that.
I'm coming over. I'm doing my full Willie Young on Paul Allen, wherever it was in the was it a 1980 Cup final? Yeah, that was the greatest professional foul of all time, wasn't it?
Poor guy, 17 years old. Alison?
Always stay on my feet if I can stay on my feet.
Mm-hmm. And always. If you're John Egan?
Oh, take him out. Completely different set of circumstances.
I see. So it's good to know, you know, all of us would have at least taken Jamie Vardy out. Nothing personal against Jamie, but we just want that point.
He took
the
glory flag out.
That's true, exactly. I wouldn't have hurt him. All it needed was a little trip. You know, there's no need to hurt the guy. But there you go. That sums up the Moral Compass of the Game podcast and all of its contributors. Thank you for listening today. I hope you've enjoyed it. Plenty more to come on Thursday as well. We'll see if Manchester United can take themselves through to the knockout stages in the Champions League. And I'm sure we'll get a response to our question about QPR versus Millwall 2. My thanks to Matt Dickinson, Alison Rudd and Gregor Robertson for being with me today. But a reminder, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times for more of the latest news from the footballing world, and read Alison's fantastic article about Jose Mourinho and the romance in North London at the moment as well. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame and you'll get yourself 1 month free.
Off Air, the podcast. with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.